Good evening, everyone. My name is Lisa Falsco, and I'm the Executive Director of the World Affairs Council. And it is my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's program. I'd like to recognize Mark Sable over here from KACN-TV. And you can purchase a DVD of the previous World Affairs Council presentations, as well as tonight's presentation, directly from KACN. And I'd also like to thank Will and Michael in the back for recording today's program for the Alaska World Affairs Council. And podcasts will be available online at kska.org. So early next week, today's program will be available for you to download on KSKA Public Radio's website. Just go to kska.org and search for AWAC Presents. Now I'd like to introduce our head table. Today we have six teachers from the Anchorage School District who went to Turkey as part of a grant we received from the Turkish Cultural Foundation. We have Stephanie Seward, Debbie Bai, Marilyn Dorr, Lee Ann Bonney, John Fick, and Kathy Steele. But before they begin, we're delighted to first present our own Sarah Swimley, who will tell us about the UAA 49th State Fellows experience this past summer in Turkey.
Hello. I am just going to take a couple minutes to talk about a trip that I took this summer through the 49th State Fellows program at UAA. Before doing so, I just want to briefly tell you what the 49th State Fellows program is. I know we have a lot of teachers out here, and I bet you'll be teaching some students who might potentially be part of our program, which we hope to see in the future. And so the 49th State Fellows program is a part of the Honors College at UAA, and we focus more on political science, history, economics, philosophy, and we take additional classes. We come to World Affairs Council events. We help sponsor the Polaris lectures at UAA. And so we try to achieve a more well-rounded, leadership-based education at UAA. And part of that involves going to Turkey. And this usually happens the summer after our junior year. And that year, we take a tutorial with our esteemed professors. And we learn all about Turkey before going there. And that was pretty fun. We got to take Turkish language lessons. We learned about the history of Turkey. We learned about Ataturk. We talked about their government, which was actually really interesting when we actually went to Turkey because we got to see it in action. And more importantly, we answered the question of why are we studying Turkey and why are we going to Turkey? And I kind of had to come to a conclusion about that by myself. They didn't just tell us, you're going to Turkey because we like it there. although, of course, President Mueller has been there, I think, more times than I've left the state of Alaska at all. And so he's a certified expert. But what I kind of discovered was the reason that we visited Turkey is because it's a lot like the United States. It's on the complete opposite side of the world, but they have a government that's fairly similar to ours, if much newer and slightly maybe less experienced. They're a secular state that's operating with a population that's primarily religious, although it's a completely different religion, and the weather might be 100% different, especially from Alaska, but I can still see the similarities between the two countries. And of course, another great reason to study Turkey, which is something that we discovered when we went there, was that it is a very, very it's culturally rich place, and has a great history. There have been several empires of really infamous people who have called Turkey part of their home. And there were the Assyrians, the Hittites, the Greeks, the Romans, the Byzantine Empire, and then most recently the Ottoman Empire, and now the Republic of Turkey, which is what we got to go visit. While we were there, we went to Istanbul, Ankara, Cappadocia, Konya, Antalya, Kalkan, Pamukkale, Gallipoli. We went all across pretty much the western half of the nation, and so we got to see a lot of it, which was really wonderful, because when you're only there for 16 days, you know, how much can you possibly see? But we managed to see quite a bit. And we saw ruins from all the civilizations that I mentioned before. There's a great museum in Ankara where we got to see Neolithic rock figurines and things like that. We visited churches that were in caves which was probably one of the most interesting and strange things in Cappadocia, which is, I think, what this picture is of here. Is part, we were in Cappadocia, where we got to spend a wonderful evening listening to some local music. Some of us partook in some local beverages, and we had a really good time. And I'll just flip through the pictures really quick. And so this is a picture from Istanbul. I think we all took that exact picture. And Katie put my classmate Katie put these pictures together, so I don't even know what they are. But this is a woman that we ran into in Ankara who was beating the, I guess it was wool that she was putting in her mattress, and so we got to help her beat it with a stick, which was pretty interesting and exciting, and probably not something that the average tour group of Turkey gets to do. And this looks like a picture of one of the markets that we visited in Istanbul. And there were tons of markets, and they were just wonderful, because that was where you really saw the difference between there and here. We don't have things like this. And there's all the haggling, right? You get to witness haggling, all the different people, the different styles of clothing, all in one place. And it's kind of a sensory overload, because there's the smells, the sights, there's all the jewelry, the clothing, the food, Turkish delight everywhere. Wonderful alma chai or apple tea, which we partook in quite regularly. So that was wonderful. It looks like another picture of Cappadocia, some of the rock churches and caves, and that's it. So yes, I just wanted to give you a really quick overview of what we saw, because you're going to be hearing a lot more about Turkey. So if you have any questions for any of the fellows, that'd be great if you asked us afterwards, too, because we'd love to tell you about our program and our personal experiences in Turkey. Thank you.
Okay. So I'm Leanne Bonney, one of the teachers that traveled to Turkey with a group of 30 teachers all together. And we started on this kind of a map overview of where we traveled. We started out in Istanbul, and then by bus went to Bursa, hit the coast of the Aegean, and Konya, and then ended our journey in Ankara. And I'm just going to go an overview of kind of the historical sites that we traveled to, and focusing on the archaeological wealth. So these are two, when you're in Istanbul, the two big sites that you see. On the left top is the Hagia Sophia, and on the bottom right is the Blue Mosque. And outside of the Blue Mosque is the Hippodrome, which was the circus arena in Constantinople during the Byzantine era. And the thing about Turkey is, as mentioned before, it was, you know, part of the Romans, part of the Greeks, the Byzantines, the Ottomans, and so you see this blending of those empires in the archaeological sites that we come across. So on the left is an obelisk that was brought from Egypt and had been in Egypt in 1490 BCE. And on the right is a Greek, part of a Greek spire that was brought in. This is within the Blue Mosque, inside the Blue Mosque. And the Blue Mosque is new by Turkish standards. It's only from 1616 CE. And it was built by the Sultan. And kind of the interesting story there is he built six minarets and got in a little trouble because the mosque in Mecca also had six, so he sent his architect to build a seventh in Mecca, so he wasn't rivaling them. This is Topkapi Palace, which was the primary residence of the Ottoman sultans for about 400 years, and the tile work in it was amazing. And probably my favorite site within Istanbul was Hagia Sophia. And I know it's kind of dark, but it was built originally as a church in about the 500s. And then when Turkey was taken over by the Ottomans, they turned it into a mosque, and now it's a museum. So here you can see in the dark, it's kind of dark, but on either side are the calligraphy of a mosque, and in the center is an icon of Mary. So it shows the influence of those two periods. And this is another view from the church. After we left Istanbul, we traveled to Ephesus, which is an ancient Greek and Roman city. And it is, you know, there's as many Roman ruins within Turkey as there are in Italy. And I think there's actually more because it hasn't been bombed through world wars as much. So these are sites of Ephesus. It had the famed Temple of Artemis was at Ephesus, which was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And this is the Library of Celsus, which is also a famous site today. And these are all Roman, and these date back to about 100 CE. And this is one of the famous stadiums of the Roman Empire, and it fits about 25,000 people in it, so it's pretty spectacular. Outside of Ephesus is the temple of Aphrodite, which is a city that was in honor of Aphrodite. Sorry. And these are sites and ruins from that place. One thing about Turkey that really impressed me is you could actually see these sites. They weren't like roped off. They weren't behind glass. And you could like go up and touch them and see the chisel marks. And the people of Turkey in Aphrodisia were actually like living among the ruins, you know, 50 years ago before they started to uncover them. We next traveled to Pamukkale, and these are terraces that are formed from hot spring mineral deposits. And this was the site of the ancient city of Hierapolis, which you can kind of see some ruins up there at the top of the white. The oldest site we traveled to was Kataholik, and this is a Neolithic archaeological site. So it dates back to about 10,000 years ago. And it is the largest and best preserved Neolithic site. And we got to see the archaeological digs and that were going on. And it's layers of basically houses, and they would collapse the houses after they wore out. So you can see here it's kind of layered of, you know, different layers of this city through about 1,000 years. The last major site we went to was Cappadocia, which they mentioned before. And these are formed through volcanic ash. And they are not only neat geologically, but there were churches built there around fourth century, and there are these small churches that have a lot of different icon paintings within them. And today, people are still living in these spires. I'm going to turn it over to John, who's going to talk a little about art and culture.
Hello, my name is John Fick. I'm a language arts teacher at Service High School, and I'm going to talk about art mostly in the vein of Sufism. I decided to focus in on that instead of giving a broad brush approach to it. So as we traveled around Turkey last summer, what I took most away from, besides too many gifts for my children, was that the country's incredible cultural blend. We saw Turkish ceramics, marbling, shadow theater, and of course carpet weavers at work. But for me, the great Persian poet Rumi, Sufism and the whirling dervishes were the most impressive symbol of the eclectic nature of Turkish culture and art. Of course, I'm a language arts geek, so go figure, right? While in Konya, located in south central Turkey, we visited Rumi's shrine and Sufi monastery, which is now a museum. There we were introduced to Sufism. This ascetic and mystical sect of Islam began as a reaction to the opulence and power wielded by the Muslim invaders and leaders during the time of the Islamic Empire almost 1,500 years ago. The famous Sufi mystic Rumi, also one of the most anthologized poets in the world, was Persian, originally from present-day Afghanistan. He moved with his family to Konya, Turkey, when he was 12, fleeing from the Mongol invaders in 1228 AD. And though he is Muslim, the poem I'm about to read here clearly shows that he believes in a personal and spiritual path to growth and enlightenment. I hope you can read that. The name of this is Wean Yourself. Little by little, wean yourself. This is the gist of what I have to say. From an embryo whose nourishment comes from the blood, move to an infant drinking milk, to a child on solid food, to a searcher after wisdom, to a hunter of more invisible game. Think how it is to have a conversation with an embryo. You might say, the world outside is vast and intricate. There are wheat fields and mountain passes and orchids in bloom. At night, there are millions of galaxies, and in sunlight, the beauty of friends dancing at a wedding. You ask the embryo why he or she stays cooped up in the dark with eyes closed. Listen to the answer. There is no other world. I only know what I have experienced. You must be hallucinating. I love one thing about Rumi is his humor. Not what most Westerners would think of being the normal Islamic line. Rumi's plain, open diction and use of analogies present complex ideas, and it reminds me of Zen Buddhist poetry. His humorous and often sensual poetry is certainly not what most of Westerners think of as Islamic, and yet Rumi's popularity as a poet in the Muslim world is unchallenged. And it is this embracing of different ideas and cultures that is a hallmark of Turkey as well. Another highlight of our trip was attending the Whirling Dervish ceremony in Konya. Rumi was a dervish himself and taught that all things, living and non-living, are connected and part of God. One way this oneness can be to God can be attained is through the Sema ceremony, this distinctive whirling and circling dance practiced by the dervishes. The Sema ceremony represents the mystical journey of an individual on their ascent through the mind and love to union with the divine. Reflecting their revolving nature of existence and all living things, the Sufi dervishes turn around the truth and grows through love, abandoning ego and embracing perfection. Then he returns from the spiritual journey as one who has at last reached perfection in order to be of service to all of creation. Dressed in long white gowns, symbolizing ego's burial shroud, and wearing high cone-shaped hats that represent ego's tombstone, the dervish can dance for hours at a time. With arms held high, the right hand is lifted upwards to receive the blessings and energy from heaven, and the left hand is turned downward to give these blessings to the earth. And the body then spins around from the right to the left, and the dervish revolves around the heart and embraces all of creation with love. The dervish form a circle, each turning in harmony with the rhythms of the accompanying music, and they circle around, slowly picking up speed and intensity until they finish in a sort of a spiritual exaltation. I actually have a video of a dervish dance. I think it's not too blurry, and hopefully, I don't know how much time we have, but I'll play at least some of it here. Thank you. that gets you that gives you just a brief snippet of what it was like. We went and saw them in Konya, and for about 30 minutes or so, they danced, and it was quite extraordinary. And there's more to it. There's an entire ritual that begins as they come out and line up, and basically then begin this rotating dance that that happens. Well, thank you very much.
Good evening. Turkey has a rich culinary culture evidenced in the wide variety of foods that can be found there. Food is to be savored and enjoyed, from the street vendors selling ice cream to the long dinners with traditional folk music. We enjoyed it very much. Foods vary according to the geographic regions within Turkey, and each region has its own specialty. Eggplant dishes, salads, and kebabs are generally found throughout the country. Islamic law prohibits the eating of pork so that one can find beef, lamb, and poultry in the cuisine. There is a traditional belief that if there is no bread served at the meal, one can't possibly leave the table satisfied. Ekmek, or bread in English, was served with every meal. On our first day, we went to a restaurant for a snack, and a woman sat in a restaurant near the dining tables, making a crepe-like bread dish for us, filled with one's choice of potato, cheese, or spinach. And of course, we had to try the Turkish coffee. Vegetables in Turkey are similar to what is available in the United States. Eggplants and artichokes are far more common than here. A typical first-course salad was an artichoke heart garnished with lightly pickled carrots and peas. Fish and seafood are in abundance. Common fish are trout and carp. The fish are often served whole, grilled with the head left on. At one luncheon, the courteous waiter offered to fillet our fish so we could eat it easily. Mussels are available everywhere and often served as a snack food from street vendors. One buys a plate of 6 mussels, which have been prepared with a tasty rice filling, and after squirting lemon on them, you tip your head back and scoot it into your mouth using the shell as a spoon. Beans, peas, chickpeas, wheat, oats, barley, millet, corn, and rye all grow in Turkey and find their way to the table as bread, pilafs, or rice at every meal. Fruit was delicious and prepared in many ways. It was served fresh, dried, stewed, or preserved. Cherries are grown in Turkey, and a tart drink made with them is very popular. In Cappadocia, a few of us were delighted to be near an apricot tree when a resourceful fellow climbed it, shook the branches, and we all gathered the fruit that fell to the ground, and it was very juicy and sweet. Spices are not only cooked in the meal, but are often served at the table in little bowls to allow each person to add to their taste, like we do with salt and pepper. Red hot pepper flakes, mint, and tart sumac were common. One outing was to the spice bazaar, a feast for the senses with dramatic colors, smells everywhere. We were invited to savor a cup of sweet pomegranate tea by a shop owner that was served in delicate tulip-shaped glasses. And I couldn't resist purchasing my own red tulip-shaped glasses to remind me of the wonderful cuisine of Turkey.
Hello, my name's Stephanie Seward, and I'm a social studies teacher at South Anchorage High School. I specifically teach government sociology and psychology. And originally, when I went to Turkey, I thought that I would bring back a lot of material to use in my U.S. government class, but I've noticed that I've been using a lot of it in my sociology class also. So today I'm going to talk to you guys a little bit about gender roles, thinking globally, and understanding diversity. And I'm also going to give to you some examples of what I've used in my classroom. This was a monument that we saw. I believe it was in Konya that we saw this. And one of the aspects in U.S. government that I want kids to understand is to think globally. And at the beginning of this semester, we talk about different forms of government. And this year, I was able to bring back some information from Turkey. Turkey is a democratic, secular, unitary, constitutional republic, which I put on the board, and it was a little hard for my students to grasp. And what we did was we kind of discussed it and broke it down, and I brought in some pictures to show them. This is specifically one of Atatürk and the Turkish flag behind him there. And another one that I brought was a plaque that we saw at the front of many of the classrooms, actually every classroom that we visited. And it was a picture of Atatürk and would have their a famous speech usually that he gave and their pledge that they had in Turkey. I've also been discussing with my students in my sociology class a lot of the different gender roles that I noticed in Turkey. We kind of noticed a lot of times that men were having different leisurely activities in the day, and we kind of wondered what was going on. At first, we thought that maybe they had a break, but apparently a lot of times the women are at home or raising the kids, and the men, you know, take breaks during the day, or they are retired. And this is just a picture of some men. I think they're playing backgammon, I believe, here, which was a pretty popular game. Another thing was the military, which was kind of interesting there. It's compulsory, so every male has to serve at least 2 years in the military. Apparently, you can put it off if you're in school, but you do have to serve 2 years there, which my students kind of find interesting. This is a man on a tractor that was excited to see us. But an interesting rite of passage that kind of caught my students' attention, especially the young men in class, in my sociology class, was a rites of passage that they have for young men at the age of 8. They have a circumcision party, which my students think is kind of interesting at the age of 8. And basically, they dress the young little boys up in a sultan costume, and for the day, the boys get to have a party. And then the deed comes towards the end of the day, and they have a party at the end. So here's just a couple of men. This is actually our first day in Istanbul, and we kind of thought this was an interesting picture of the two men with the big hookah, but after a while we realized that it was kind of normal. I use this one in my socialization aspect in sociology class, and I thought this was just such a beautiful moment. There's a father there with his two sons, and the little son that has his head down praying, he was kind of acting up in the mosque and kind of being rowdy. And the father and the middle son, or the older son, they kind of hit him with their elbow and were telling him to shape up. And the dad was modeling to them how to pray correctly in the mosque. And so there's a little boy trying to imitate his brother and his father. We kind of experienced our own little, I don't know if you call it gender discrimination or not, but we were really excited to go to this 300-year-old Turkish bath in Istanbul, a few of us here. And we got there, and we were with some of the guys from our party, too. I think they were Montana guys. And they were allowed in, but we were not, the females. Apparently, the females aren't allowed in after a certain time. So we got kicked out of the bath. But the men went in and had a relaxing time. I took a couple pictures of the females in the mosque because I thought this was really interesting. This is one I think is a beautiful picture. And you can see, of course, her head is covered. And this was the area of the mosque where the women have to pray. And it was actually in the back corner, which was kind of interesting. And I showed this one to my students also. You can also notice their clothing is a lot more conservative than maybe some of the women you would see out on the street. And here is just a picture of the women's clothing. You'll notice, I think Kathy will talk too a little bit about how people dress, women especially, dress differently in Turkey. This is a picture we had in one of the bazaars. You can see the different style of clothing. We also kind of noticed that a lot of the men tend to operate the shops, and they're quite the salesmen, that's for sure. This is my last slide of just an elderly woman selling some doilies and crochets that she had made. I also wanted to note that today it was a little improv. I've had some problems tying in Turkey to my psychology class, but it was a spur-of-the-moment activity today. We were talking about sensory and perception in my psych class, and I have a little whirling dervish I brought back from Turkey, and it spins around, and it's at the front of my classroom on my desk, and I use it as an example today of your perception. If you spin in a circle, how is it that the dervishes don't get dizzy? My students, that's their homework tonight, so we'll see how they do. Thank you.
My name is Kathy Steele. I teach English at Chugiak High School, 11th and 12th graders, and our language teacher is here from our training, and so I wanted to say merhaba. Merhaba, okay. Thank you so much for having us here tonight. The down arrow? Okay. I'm not sure how many times you can look at this and continue to appreciate it, but we were just enthralled when we got to Istanbul to see this lovely picture, and it changes as the day progresses. And so here's for your enjoyment yet another picture of the Blue Mosque. We took a lovely boat ride on the Bosphorus early in our trip, and since I'm talking to you tonight about contrast, I thought this was a lovely analogy of Istanbul, because Istanbul is part in Europe and part in Asia. And so I thought this would be symbolic of the two cultures and the East and the West coming together on the Bosphorus. And then we have, of course, modern commerce on this age-old river that has been a trade route for thousands of years. And then we have this contrast of the Turkish flag, whose governance has only been not even quite 100 years yet. As we were on our boat trip that morning, we saw this 14th century fortress, and just a smidge over to the right is a Hilton Hotel. So there again, we have the contrast of the old and new that we find all over Turkey, especially in Istanbul. And this is a weird picture, and I just want to explain it. We had a lovely few days in Istanbul, and at maybe our second or third day, I'm not sure, we went high up on a hill overlooking the Bosphorus to this amazing, I think it was a Chamber of Commerce type organization. And they served us at lunch the most fantastic meal, elegant, absolutely elegant and delicious. And we were enjoying this completely modern, fabulous meal as we looked over the Bosphorus, where so much history has taken place, and I thought it was just very significant. As our trip progressed, we went into some rural areas, and this is one of the rural schools in a village called Karakasu. And you can see, you may be able to see Ataturk's picture on the side there, but it was a fairly old-fashioned way to teach small classrooms, and this is an elementary school. So this is one of the older things that we saw. And then as part of our trip in Istanbul, we went to a more modern school that is financed by the state. Is that right, guys? Okay, that one was financed by the state. And on one of our trips, we found this thoroughly modern school principal. And I don't think it hurts that she's a hottie, too. She's very attractive. She's a very attractive lady. I showed my students this picture, and they went, "What? Our principals don't look like that." And in one of our stops at another school, we found an amazing array of technology, and it was a privately funded school. The kids were carefully selected and had to have very high test scores, be very motivated to attend this school, and it is a partial boarding school as well. And you've seen one of these slides of the spice market. One of the contrasts for me that was so interesting was that we have modern commerce going on in buildings that have harbored places to sell things and markets for thousands of years. And so, I don't know, the picture is just pretty too, and the spices were lovely. This is a really wonderful thing. And you saw this picture too. Leanne had this picture. But I captured this guy because, and he's selling these little bread sesame seed snacks. And I thought it was just such an interesting contrast with this very old way of selling snacks at this place, at this very old place, the Hippodrome. And this picture is some very modern women who have assimilated into the culture in Turkey. And, of course, we wanted to be very respectful when we were going into the mosque. And so, of course, we complied with what they wanted. And this is a picture of at the Hagia Sophia of some of the frescoes, a fresco that was covered up when it became a mosque. This is a Christian fresco covered up by some in the mosque, and then recently they have begun to uncover these and use them as museum pieces, which I think is just a really interesting contrast. And this one is a dark one because it is a dark, dark passageway. And I loved this picture. This is one of Marilyn's pictures because this is a walkway that has been worn smooth and shiny. Thousands and thousands of pilgrims and worshipers going along this path. I found this to be a really interesting shot, too, because we have this very traditionally clad older lady sitting with her two daughters who have made different decisions about how to dress in Turkey. And I love, love, love this picture. I don't know this woman, and I kind of sneaked up on her and took her picture. We just left the Blue Mosque, and she was out of those garments that we needed to put on in a heartbeat. And this, we didn't capture her shoes, but she has on screaming red shoes, really, really high heels. So we have this lovely modern woman just taking a few steps out of the Blue Mosque. And Leanne talked about Katahoyuk as well, and I was very touched and moved by being at this dig. The idea of being somewhere where others have trod 10,000 years ago was just an amazing thing to me. And I actually picked up a handful of dirt at this dig, which I think if it were anywhere else, maybe we wouldn't be able to do that. But I just felt of the dirt and was so moved by the moment that 10,000 years this dirt has done what it's supposed to do, and people have used it and lived there. It was just so amazing to me. It was lovely. And this is a picture, I think, of something. I'm not sure if it's Ephesus or if the temple is Ephesus. Okay. Just amazing, amazing preservation in the artifacts. And just a few miles from this, we found ourselves in the most luxurious hotel that had every amenity that you could possibly imagine, and were vicarious guest at a wedding at the hotel that night, which was just great fun. But all of this to say, it was a beautiful country. It was the people are beautiful and welcoming, and Turkey certainly bears a second visit for all of us.
Yeah, my name is Debbie Bai, and I teach history and Alaska Studies at South Anchorage High School. And even though they're not here, the Turkish Cultural Foundation, I'd like to really thank them. This was a wonderful, wonderful trip, and I always think of travel as my professional development. And as a teacher of history, I go many places and bring those experiences back to my students. And we are just now actually studying the Middle East and Turkey as well. Okay, I'm going to talk about a little bit of history and how it's secular, because that's something that made a big point with me. And I took a lot of people pictures, just trying to get some different things from Turkey to bring back. And the one woman and her husband on the right, I especially liked her henna feet, so that's why I have her feet in the middle of the picture as well. And then you have so many different interpretations of what being a Muslim means in Turkey, and so that's kind of how I'm starting out. This is just from www.adherence.com, and I wanted to go in and see, okay, these are major world religions. At least this is this particular URL's take on it. So you can see that Christianity, according to them, is about 33% in the world, and Islam is about 21%. But within Islam, there are several breakdowns as well. This is another picture of the Blue Mosque, and we were 5 days in Istanbul. And so I'm not going to go over all the history because I don't think I need to, but I put some facts about, some very basic facts about Islam up here, kind of when it got started. And one of the things that made a big impression on me is that I expected Turkey not to be as secular as it was. And as we went from museum to museum, one of the things that I discovered and was shown to me is that Turkey was actually very slow in coming to Islam compared to other countries. And it wasn't until the 10th century. So when you look at maps from different periods, you see that that's one of the reasons I believe that it is what it is today. This is a picture coming out of the Blue Mosque and looking across the way to the Hagia Sophia. And so those two places were very significant. I think for most of us, we all have pictures of that. But I just like the framing. And the Blue Mosque was the first mosque that I've ever been in. The Hagia Sophia is not really considered a mosque anymore. It was made a museum in the 1930s. And so you don't have to wear a scarf there. I think most of us did, just because we were trying to become more accustomed, and I don't think we knew till after we were in there that it was a museum and not necessarily a mosque. So this is a little bit of the history from Constantinople to Istanbul. And the Turks, we found out, had been very nomadic and had come from Central Asia. They settled in Anatolia after the defeat of the Byzantines. In 1071, Constantinople was named after the first Christian emperor, Constantine, and there's a lot of story that goes with that. Constantinople was conquered in 1453 when the Ottoman Turks under Mehmed I defeated Constantinople. It was then renamed Istanbul, and there's a lot of great story that goes with that as well. And that's when the churches were turned into mosques, including the Hagia Sophia. And as a result of all of these conquerings, the Ottomans consolidated their empire in Anatolia, Thrace, and throughout that region. This is the Blue Mosque again, before I had a whole bunch of people in front of me. And so I just thought it was very peaceful. I love the windows and the lighting. And this is the Hagia Sophia from our hotel, actually, where we had breakfast. And then I go into the Ottoman Empire, which spanned from 1281 to 1922. The Arabian script is from the Hagia Sophia when it was a mosque. And part of what happened is the title of caliph was revived under the Ottomans. This is going to, under Ataturk, be taken away again as part of the making it more secular. Justice was dispensed during this period by religious courts using the Sharia, which is the system of justice by the religious segment. Non-Muslims were always free to worship as they wished to under most Islamic rule. And some of the people that you may have heard of at the time before, besides Mehmed I, was Suleiman the Magnificent. This is just a picture of the Ottoman Empire in 1683, and there's a key on the bottom that shows how it grew from 1300 until 1683. So Constantinople is kind of there in the middle with the pink. And then one of the last places we went, and this is where the secular Islam came about, is through Ataturk, otherwise known as very, very charismatic general named Mustafa Kemal, and he is known as the father of Turkey. And he's the one that put into place the democracy, made it a republic, made it secular. He reformed Turkey in three major ways, and that would be social reforms, legal reforms, and political reforms. And if we can just look at the social reforms, some of the things he mandated were that the men would no longer wear the fez, women would not wear veils, especially at school and at work, and that continues today. There were no caliphs. He changed the alphabet into a Latin alphabet, and there is no Arabic script or oral use of Arabic in their mosques. All girls were allowed to attend school, and it was one of the first countries to give women the right to vote, and that was 1930, and that was before most of the Western European countries did. The picture on the right is Ataturk. The last city we visited was Ankara, and there was quite a magnificent grounds in honor of Ataturk, and we spent quite some time there, and it was very interesting. Some of the legal reforms is the Sharia was eliminated. The Ottoman Sultanate was eliminated, that office. Law was now to be dispensed under civil law. There were only civil marriages. So the marriage that we saw Kathy was talking about was outside, and it was strictly just a civil marriage. And then the Gregorian calendar was adopted, rather than using the Islamic calendar. Political reforms, religious education was restricted and taken under government control. Religious authorities' functions and powers were reduced and later eliminated. So in my mind, what secular Islam really means is that while 98% of the country is Muslim, there are Jews, there are Christians there, but the way that they practice Islam, even our tour bus guide, and he was a very very educational, very sophisticated guy, he explained to us that most Muslims that he knows are like him, and he only goes to the mosque on Fridays. And that would be very common, and you would still call yourself a practicing Muslim, but they don't pray as many times as people in other countries who are practicing Muslims, and you just don't see the mosques as full as you would in other countries. So today, and this is a picture from the Grand Bazaar, Turkey is the most westernized of the Islamic countries. I thought about putting a list up there, but there's, you know, it's quite a list of Islamic countries. Turkey, the people in Turkey consider themselves European. They don't consider themselves Asian. And I put EU up there because right now one of the big issues is they're trying to get into the European Union. 80% are Sunni Muslims. The remaining 18% of the 98 are Shia and Alevi. I found this number, 120,000 Christians and 26,000 Jewish people. And the way it was explained to me by one of the people on a trip who visits Turkey often is that people see themselves first as Turks and then second as Muslims. Now, I'm sure you would find people who would argue with that. But that's the way it was described to me by one of another one of the guides who came along with us. And I already mentioned the thing about the guides, and that's it. So I'd like to really thank you for having us here, and I'd really like to thank the Turkish Cultural Foundation. It was a wonderful trip. I hope to take my family back someday because I really had so much fun. I learned so much, and it was very rewarding. And Professor, I hope I didn't get too many of those history points wrong. Thank you.
We do have one other little thing that we'd like to do. If we could have Lisa and Kari come up here, please. There is certainly no way that we could adequately express to you our appreciation for all the work that went into our going to Turkey. The day of training was the most fun and great food, and that wasn't even the trip yet. Mm-hmm. So we just brought a token for your office, and we wanted to tell you symbolically how much we appreciate all the effort that you've gone to for our trip. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And if we can take some questions, if you'll raise your hand, the microphone will come to you for recording on the radio and TV. So just raise your hand.
What is the current total population of Turkey?
I remember that Istanbul was about, it was like 12 to 15 million.
70 million, I believe. About 70 million.
Did you get into a discussion about the Kurds and the Kurdish area?
As a matter of fact, we did. In fact, one of the Turkish guides that was with us explained it. Actually, I heard a couple of conversations, And the basic feeling of the Turks seems to be that that definitely during that time period that lots of Armenians died, lots of people died in general after the during that time period, and but that there was no real state orchestrated genocide or purposeful extermination of them or movement of them. And it was all part of the times and the movement, civil wars going on and whatnot. And so they believe that that while some people are responsible, individuals were responsible for heinous kind of acts, and that they were punished, evidently, that it wasn't... It can't be called genocide because it wasn't a state-sponsored activity, like Nazi Germany, where you know they had a program of exterminating the Jews, and so that's basically their feeling about it, and that's why they take umbrage at the label of genocide, and they just basically say that it wasn't really it was just a product of the times, and Orhan, our tour guide, talked several times about the movement of peoples in that part of the world for centuries being displaced by invaders and whatnot, and that lots of Turks don't know where their ancestors even come from because there's been so much movement in that area historically. Does that make sense?
Well, actually, I think he's... Oh, thank you. I have a very loud voice. They tell me that at school all the time. Yay. Talking about the Kurds, though, which is different, yeah, my feeling from everyone that I talked to and from the literature I read, because I tried to read 3 or 4 books before I left just to have a better feeling, is that they are almost the country bumpkin of Turkey in terms of they are the minority, they don't have the great industry and commerce and the wealth that comes from that the rest of the country has. And so my feeling about the Kurds is that they kind of talk about them as, those are those other people. They're kind of outside the main trading places and the main metropolitan areas. And they were, I think, a little bit looked down upon. Now, when we went to the rug-making place, though, they did talk about lots of the rugs were made in those areas, and lots of that, you know, that was the trading of the Kurds, was the rugs. But I don't remember, you guys, anybody else want to join in here? But I almost felt as though they were a little bit looked down upon because they're from more than one country. They're not just from Turkey, and they are up in the hills, and they don't have as much money, and they don't have as much education, and they have much greater economic needs.
I do want to redeem myself a little bit. I'm sorry, I was thinking about it different. I did meet a couple of people who, out on the street talking to them and whatnot, who proudly proclaimed the fact that they were Kurd. So I think they're proud people, and it's just that they're from the eastern part of the country, of course, a little less economically powerful and whatnot, so...
Just in the last few weeks, we've been having speakers discuss things like the Palestinians and the Jews and their ability to live together peacefully and such. And it sounds like in Turkey there's quite a good mixture and there doesn't seem to be any of the problems. I know that in Jerusalem and such, there's other things at large there. But this seems to be a pretty cohesive community in spite of any differences between religions and such.
Well, I just think, you know, thinking about, you know, what I talked about a little bit, if you go back in history, Islam was, even though they conquered people, they also allowed them to continue to worship the way they had worshipped before they were conquered. And so I think that kind of shows up a little bit more in Turkey, maybe than I even thought, you know, expected.
It seems to me that one of the things that's been happening in Turkey lately, though, is that there's a growing fundamentalist Islam movement. Did you run into that at all? And isn't the Kurdish question one of the reasons they're not yet in the EU? Or they're having trouble with NATO or something? I'm fuzzy, but I'm curious about the fundamentalist Islam because it seemed a little scary a couple of years ago. You know, they had an election and more fundamentalists were elected.
Well, I talked to a few of the people that were on our tour, and definitely among we had the wife of our tour guide join us, and she talked kind of about this fear that women have that they're going to, you know, be forced at some day to wear the veil. And then I was talking to some of the people that they were afraid their current president, who is more openly Muslim, is going to reform the country and, you know, get rid of alcohol and make it more of a fundamentalist Muslim country.
On maybe the third day we were there, I was at the lovely dinner that Kathy told you about up on the hill, and somebody asked a question, and we got into the whole Armenian issue, but also the EU. And I know there were several issues, but it seems like that is something that the country is really rallying behind, trying to get into, because it'll be great stimulus economically. And I know that some of the issues with getting into the EU were continuing issues with women. I know that the Kurdish issue was one of the issues. I think they actually got a list of things from the EU that they need to work on. And those are the two that came up over and over again. But they are trying to prove that they're more European than Asian. And I think for most of us here, that we would probably agree that it feels more European. And I think the college student said it best when she said, "It, you know, many things felt like they do here." And so they are really kind of riding that wave. They really want to get into the EU. That's really probably the number one issue.
Hi. Last night, one of my classmates was speaking at our fellows meeting about the fact that in certain areas that they went to, there was actually a people there didn't quite agree with the reforms that Ataturk had made to the state of Turkey. And did you experience any of that, maybe of people that didn't agree with some of those changes?
I can say that we never heard a negative word about Ataturk. I never did. He's a pretty revered figure. And in fact, we had some discussions about an equivalent in the United States, or if there was, or even in the world, you know, George Washington. And since he's much more close in historical times, I never heard anybody say anything negative about Ataturk. I think he's pretty revered still.
In Turkey, do people speak English?
No, in Turkey they speak Turkish, but we had no problem getting around with English also.
Okay, thank you very, very much.
I would like to thank our six teachers. I forgot to mention that last year we were able to sponsor, through the Turkish Cultural Foundation, four teachers to go to Turkey. And this year they increased that to six, and we made some great selections. Congratulations. We would like to give all of you a membership to the World Affairs Council and one of our magnet clips as a thank you. And we would also like to do the same for our 49th State Fellows. And if you would like to come up here, I have a clip and a membership. Our next program will be on Friday the 13th, upstairs back in the chart room with Professor Bob Musil, who's the former director of the 1985 Nobel Peace Prize winning organization, Physicians for Social Responsibility. And he will be here to speak on Stopping Global Warming, Signs of Hope. The doors will open at 11:30 and we'll start at 12. Have a great evening.